Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll begin today with someone who helped create and define a culture. Dan Barber, one of the early and high-profile champions of the local food movement. He's the award-winning chef and co-owner of the Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns restaurants, both in New York. He's winner of multiple James Beard Awards and has been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world, all because of his innovative, farm-to-table cooking.
But not long ago, Barber had a culinary epiphany. He was visiting a small wheat farm in upstate New York when he realized that despite its good intentions, the local food movement had failed.
Let's say it again, because this might be causing a bit of cognitive dissonance right now, especially since we're right in the season where all of these local farmers and farmers markets are really gearing up. But here it is. Dan Barber says the local food movement has failed. Specifically, it has failed to change the way we eat and more fundamentally how we view the entire process of food production.
As he wrote in the New York Times, the farm-to-table movement is a passive system, a grocery aisle mentality, when really, as cooks and eaters, we need to engage in the nuts and bolts of true agricultural sustainability.
Dan Barber further expands on this thinking in his new book titled The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. He joins us now in the studio. Dan Barber, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon, team. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, let's get right to it. How specifically do you think the local food movement has failed to really change the way we both eat and think about food? Because I think a lot of people might say, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should say I'm a card-carrying member of the farm-to-table movement. I not only have a farm-to-table restaurant. Actually, I have a restaurant in the middle of a farm. I also own a family farm. So I've got a skin in the game here. But what I've realized in the research for this book, and the book didn't start with this premise. In fact, it started just with the premise of I was in search of these like jaw-droppingly delicious foods, and I went in search of how they were grown or raised. That was what set me off away from my restaurant and to these different farms and farmers. And what I realized in the research is I kept asking the wrong question. It wasn't how they were grown or raised. It was the whole system that supported them. And that got me around ultimately to realizing that the farm-to-table movement doesn't get us to support that system. It doesn't allow us even to realize it. And what we do instead is cherry pick ingredients like we do at the farmer's market or any supermarket.
Right. So it seems as if you're saying it's not just about those succulent heirloom tomatoes or those perfect, parsnips that
come out. Yeah, the all-stars of the farm-to-table movement, which you know, those are great too, but those are really the cream of the crop. And that's where that culinary epiphany moment came in about 10 years ago when I had a taste of this farmer Klaus's in upstate New York, Klaus Martin's wheat. It's just that there was the most unbelievably delicious. It was emmer wheat, and we bake this bread with it, you know. And the diners went totally nuts for this. People wanted to sell their firstborn for this another slice of this bread, and yet, I went to the farm, you know, a year and a half or two after I first started baking with it, and I looked around 2,000 acres and realized there was no wheat growing, but there was a suite of different crops, barleys and mullets and buckwheats, and then cover crops like brassicas and leguminous crops, bean crops, Austrian winter peas, all these crops that were planted and moved about in a very meticulous way around the field, all timed perfectly so that the soil could get the fertility it needed to grow the wheat that I so coveted.
Right.
And that's when I realized, wait a minute, I got to support the whole game here if I'm going to support the wheat.
Not just the end product.
And
in fact, the way you write about Lakeview Organic,
farm right.
that Klaus and Mary Howell Martin's own in upstate New York, I mean, you write about it as if, you know, they say they allow the soil to speak to them.
Yeah.
About, like, how to best care for it.
Yeah, well, he taught me a language, Klaus, which sounds it sounds a little kumbaya, you know, I'm talking to the soil. But that's really what I did with each visit. And I got okay. I mean, look, it's a language. So I sort of started to dabble in it, but it changed my life. You know, even on the train right here, I was thinking about it. this morning. I passed some farmland on the way and some open fields. And what Klaus taught me is that different flowers, different weeds that are shooting up in the middle of the field, on the side of the fields, are the soil talking to us about what it needs. So, you know, you see yellow flowers and you know the soil is low in zinc, and you see milkweed and you know it needs selenium, and you see foxtail and you see that the soil is compacted too much and needs to breathe. So really, like, I was sitting on a train, I was like, you know, it's a little bit like the soil's waving to me. Yeah. You know, and it's speaking. I'll never look at a field in the same way after my experience with him. And the interesting thing isn't to commune with nature, although it's a nice benefit to a train ride. The interesting thing for a chef and for anyone who cares about good food is that language is a very clear signal into the path you need to take, a farmer needs to take, to get to that great flavor. Because the soil, when it's fed right, will provide us with all the nutrients and flavor we need.
So I want to talk with you in a minute much more about supporting the whole farm, as you were talking about. But I also want to ask you specifically about something that you write about in the book, The Third Plate, about this idea that basically the farm-to-table or the local food movement hasn't done much to sort of break what you call an odd duality, which is that we've had this food revolution in terms of people's awareness about where their food comes from and the quality that they're searching for. But it's done nothing to change what you call an entrenched status quo in terms of food production.
Yeah, well, nothing. Maybe I exaggerated a little bit, but what the hell? I mean, no, it's done something. I mean, look, the food farm table movement, it's a viral, social, exciting social movement, maybe the most exciting social movement in America today. And it's creating a lot of consciousness. And, you know, there's been a lot of change in 10 years that's very inspiring. My point is only the duality part of it is on the on-the-ground reality, which has just come out. The U.S. Census came out at the beginning of the month, and it stated very clearly, big agriculture is getting bigger. It's not getting smaller. You know, we're now at a point, the first time in the history of America, the first time in the history of human civilization since we started agriculture 10,000 years ago, we have less than 1% of the farmers feeding nearly 50% of the people in this country, and we have a million acres of virgin farmland in the Midwest plowed up. Now, we haven't seen that since the great plow up of the 1930s, and that led to the Dust Bowl. So we are looking at a system of agriculture, industrialized system of agriculture, that's only getting bigger in the face of a very exciting social movement that is saying, we don't want to eat this way. Mm. So how do we square that?
Well, I guess what I was trying to get at was your point completely taken. But in that excerpt that Anthony was reading at the introduction here, where you talked about how the farm-to-table movement is still essentially a passive system in terms of how people think about food. You call it a grocery aisle mentality when we're just thinking about the end product. And that wasn't necessarily the intention of the movement at all, but that it seems to have only further focused people's attention on those, you know, star end products.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the fallacy of the farm table movement. It sounds direct and connected, but at the end of the day, it's the farmer that's bringing to market what he or she knows you will buy. There's an expectation there. And unfortunately, what the farmer's not bringing to the market, because he knows we won't buy it, are the in-between crops, the crops that need to be rotated to get you those cream crops, those tomatoes, those parsnips, those peas, the asparagus. And instead, those crops are either being plowed in as cover crops or they're being fed to animals in the case of Klaus, which is a very inefficient use of both calories, but also, more importantly, from Klaus's standpoint, the economic return for the farmer is very low.
Right.
And so all those crops that I saw, the dozens and dozens of crops that go into animal feed and not to us, delicious crops, by the way, barley and buckwheat and rye and those beans that I talked about, those are all delicious crops that I love now to prepare at the restaurant. I wasn't supporting those. And Klaus, the farmer, was making pennies on the dollar compared to what he can sell, what he can make selling to chefs like me or to eaters like you.
So in the book, and you call for, and I hear this, the same call coming now in terms of that we as consumers, as eaters of good food, need to change the way we think about what and how we eat. And then also, which sort of would have an upstream effect on supporting those very farmers who may be adopting practices such as the Martins. Well, listeners, I'm speaking with Dan Barber. He is the award-winning chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns restaurants, both in New York. His new book is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food, when he talks about reimagining the farm-to-table movement and supporting the whole farm. I'm wondering what you think about this. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Do you think there are problems or limitations with the farm-to-table movement and how it has helped us shape our new concept of food? Does it feel like a passive system to you? And do you feel excited about the idea of maybe eating those legumes and barleys that Dan Barber is talking about? Call us again at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Lots of things to talk about regarding this new way of thinking about food. And Dan, I'm wondering if you could just describe to us, first of all, I'm looking at this this excerpt from Time magazine from March where there's this photograph of a plate with what would be sort of a supporting the whole farm kind of meal. So from your chef's perspective, what does that mean? What do we serve?
Well, so in that example, it's trying to upend the archetype of a American expectation for dinner, which is the 8-ounce steak. And so we've done that at the restaurant by serving a parsnip steak, which sort of takes center cut on the plate as the predominant architecture. And then the supporting ingredients are things like a little marmalade of beef shank, which is an underused part of the animal that's stunningly delicious. And we use a meat sauce. So it's not a meatless and we use a marrow to garnish. So it's really a steak dinner, but it's turned on its head. And for me, it makes a real run at the T-bone of the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was looking at it, and unfortunately, the only copy I have is a black and white one, so yeah. I'm sure it sings more in color.
Yeah.
Excuse me, but it was a really interesting idea.
Tastes good, too, by the way.
And I guess, I'm coming from your hands, no, I doubt
thanks.
It. I mean, I don't doubt it at all. But I guess what I was trying to get at is, when you after you had this epiphany, right, and you were thinking about, okay, well, what can I do here to support the whole farm? As a chef, so you're standing in your kitchen, you think, I want to put more legumes on the menu. I want to put more barleys on the menu. How did you put all this stuff together?
The third plate. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do is put it together. Now, it's a work in progress, and it's a hard thing to do, but mainly because the culture, which is to say the American culture, which is a really unique essentially, it's a unique soil situation. We have a ton of fertility. We've had a ton of fertility for the last 250 years, 300 years, and we have been on a kind of joyride where we've been able to support that 8-ounce steak as the centerpiece of our dining experience three times a day, and protein's taken center stage because we've had an incredible farming anomaly, which unfortunately we've not only adopted as our cultural expectations for dinner, but also we're exporting it now, and it's something we can't afford. By the way, it's not always that delicious. I'm not against a steak. I love steak, and I love to indulge. But it's really part of the reason I love it is because it feels like an indulgence. So I do it from time to time. But I think what we have to do as a culture is think about a new way of eating, which is really a cuisine. It's a pattern of eating, which is like any cuisine. There is no cuisine in the world. No cuisine. All the cuisines that we love, Southern, Italian, French, the thousands of Chinese cuisines of Southern China, the millions in India. I mean, none of them have what we have, what we expect for dinner. So it's almost laughable. They were all evolved out of the hardships of essentially peasant farming, but they all were co-evolving with what the landscape could provide, and they established a pattern of eating that became a culture, that became delicious cuisine. We have to do much of the same thing.
Well, in hearing you describe that, though, I'm wondering if you're saying that one of the challenges that you face right now as a chef who could be who is at the vanguard of rethinking the farm-to-table movement is that are you concerned that maybe your diners don't necessarily want this stuff?
Yeah, well, okay. So I mean, that's a fair question, and I have to be very honest here and say, you know, we do get some pushback. I mean, we generally at my restaurant at Stone Barns, we serve somewhere between 30 and 40 courses a night, these tasting menus. And after, say, the 10th course, which is sometimes just a course you eat with your hands, it's sometimes just a few bites, it's sort of rapid fire a dining experience. And invariably, more than once a night, we get a table calling over a captain and saying, this has been great, but where's my meat course? And what we say back is, you've been eating meat in actually every course. You know, you've been eating it as a sauce, or actually there's meat in the vinaigrette, or there's cured meat in that dish. But it just doesn't take center stage, and that's what we need to change. That. So we're in a bit of a transition. It's going to be a bit of a long transition, but I'm totally invested in this, in part because I think it really is the more delicious way to eat. But the expectation has got to change. By the way, there's a bit of a top down thing. You know, I don't mean to sound like Reagan revolutionary guy, but I do believe this is sort of trickle down. It's like, this isn't a bottom-up revolution in this sense. I mean, the farm-to-table movement has been bottom-up, but chefs play a huge role in this next iteration of it, because we are arbiters of taste, and we can actually create an architecture to the plate that becomes infused, bleeds into the culture in a way that I think has really great promise, especially if it's delicious.
Well, actually, I mean, I feel like this is a wonderful example of I don't mean to make this a pun, but tastemakers really driving like the American palate or yeah. taste. So are you in fact sort of calling on your fellow chefs to really rethink the whole yeah. structure of how they do what they do?
I am, but unfortunately they're already doing it. So I wish I could call, you know, I'm like Gandhi of the movement, but in fact, nothing of the sort. I mean, I'm just looking at what's happening around, and the most exciting chefs today are turning the notion of gourmet dining on its head. It's no more lobster, caviar, and foie gras. That's not the essence of truly great cuisine. Today, in today's American dining and increasingly throughout the world, it's taking these uncoveted, unheralded vegetables, grains, and cuts of meat and turning them into something delicious. In part, it's that way, not because chefs are all environmentalists or ecologists or nutritionists, although most of us are by de facto. It's that we are all challenged by the idea of doing this, because it really truly is cooking. Heating up a center cut steak cooking a center cut piece of protein is really heating dinner, not cooking.
Right. Well, listeners, I'm speaking with Dan Barber again. He's the award-winning chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns Restaurant in New York, and his new book is The Third Plate. We've got a bunch of callers who want to talk to you, Chef Barber, so let's hear from them. Steve is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Steve.
Meghna and Dan, I'm going to be part devil's advocate and part skeptic here. Back in the 60s and 70s, we were told that because of overpopulation, the world was going to starve to death. Yet, because of big agriculture, we do not have the famine that was predicted. So I'm hoping that you give big agriculture some credit for that. That's my first point. My second point, to be quick, is most of the food stuffs that you're talking about are very, very labor intensive and necessarily very expensive. We have a lot of people in the United States who can't afford to eat that way. What do you say to them?
So I'll take, if you don't mind, I'll take the second question first, which is let's look at that example of standing in the 2,000-acre mixed crop field and not seeing any wheat and seeing all these other unheralded crops that I wasn't cooking with. So part of the reason that my wheat, my heirloom local wheat, was so expensive was because of these sunk costs that I was looking at. I wasn't supporting the unheralded crops that this farmer needed to grow to get me my wheat. So he was covering the costs of growing the wheat or growing these cover crops and these rotational crops to feed his soil by charging me more for the wheat. So I think there's quite a bit of lost income, especially if we're eating it through meat, because we're eating a very inefficient system. And to your first question, feeding the world, I don't take any credit away from big agriculture for creating more calories in the world in the last 50 years. What I take exception to is when people say that the third plate or the chefs who are leading the charge on this movement for the future as elitists and not in tune with being able to feed a growing population. The experts predict 9 billion people by 2050. And how could we possibly feed a growing world when people are starving today? And the answer is, and I think it's a quite straightforward answer. Unfortunately, it sounds a little bit hard headed by a hard-hearted, but I really mean it as a hard-headed answer, which is that we already produce enough calories to feed 12 billion people. The question now is the, there's a real inequality in distribution, and we eat with great inefficiencies, especially with the amount of meat we eat and the type of meat we eat, which is essentially grain-fed. Those are all sunk costs, and we could be doing a lot more to feed a growing population if we just change the pattern of eating.
Okay, so let me actually ask you a question that blends both of Steve's points here, and that is that, you know, I take your point about that corporate or agribusiness is here to stay. It is a part of the food system overall. But if indeed there are all these extra efficiencies to be gathered from this new way of farming and this new way of conceiving of food, the crop rotation, the allowing the soil to sort of tell you what it needs so that you have a bigger bounty the next season, et cetera, why not advocate for those similar efficiencies to be transferred to agribusiness? Because I feel like that could that possibly be a win-win there? I mean, or is agribusiness just saying there is no demand for, you know, 18 trillion bushels of barley?
Yeah, right. I mean, if agribusiness wanted to adopt a rotational agriculture system, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I'd be cheerleading them all the way to the bank, because ultimately, if they felt they could make money doing that, soils would improve dramatically, and our nutrition, our nutrient density would go through the roof compared to what it is now. Essentially now, 50% of our harvestable acres are in corn and soy. Now, that's not a very healthy food system. So my problem with the caller's question, the first question was, well, you know, we're producing a lot of calories. Sure, but we're producing a lot of corn and soy. So if you were to take an industrial farm in Iowa and compare it to that farm in upstate New York of Klaus's, and you were to compare how much corn is harvested off of each farmer's farm, undoubtedly, the Iowa farm would absolutely produce more corn than Klaus's farm, and they would produce in Kansas more wheat than Klaus's farm. But if you were to take the whole farm, the entire farm, the tonnage, the calories produced off the farm, Klaus's farm produces a lot more calories. It just doesn't produce a lot more corn and wheat, and that's the difference. And that's the false logic of the people who say you can't feed the world on a diversified crop system.
Well, let's take another call. India is calling from Dorchester. You're on the air, India.
Hi, Dan and Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. I am a former restaurant chef and restaurateur, and I have gone private now. And in working for families, I realized that in this working family culture, many people don't know how to cook, or they just simply don't have time to cook. And I've changed my whole cooking strategy personally and professionally, and do a lot more whole grains. And the thing about them is that they take a lot of time, and people just don't have that time. And so I think that there needs to be a way for people to get them, you know, easily incorporated into their daily lives, besides the time factor,
right,
so that they can, you know, do them.
Well, let's turn, if India, if I may, let's turn that question back to Dan Barber. I mean, I think she brings up a good point, especially if you're not familiar already mm-hmm. with recipes or ways to cook these other grains.
Well, let's also just push back a little bit and say that we are now in a time where access to learning about how to cook all kinds of different foods, all kinds of diversity, is easier than it's ever been. There's
so
more information
YouTube
on the
it.
Internet. Yeah, I mean, there's more information out there now than there was, than there ever has been, and it's a very exciting time if you're interested in investing the time. But the call is right. I mean, there are very few hours in the day, and this comes down to a question of priorities, because, you know, Michael Pollan talks about this a lot in his book, Cooked. It's if you prioritize this stuff, as in you find it to be rewarding, not just nutritious, but rewarding, you know, cultural experience for yourself in the daily workings of your hectic lives, this becomes a very important and rewarding experience that makes it the time well worth it.
Mm. I wonder if you look at the spread of farmers markets, especially not uniformly across the country, but in certain places, you know, you can't really go to a neighborhood without seeing a farmers market, as sign of the fact that Americans can aggressively change their preferences for food. And does that give you hope for optimism?
Yeah, boy, that's a home run of a question, and because it sort of determines the answer. The answer is yes. I mean, look at how nimble our food eating culture is. We are not Japan. We are not French. And there's nothing where they have great cuisines and great cultures around a certain pattern of eating, a cuisine that is to a certain extent inflexible, and for good reason. It's absolutely delicious, and it's part of their culture. Americans suffer from the lack of cuisine, but to your point, it's also an advantage. We are so nimble, and we are able to adopt new strategies and covet new ingredients and new ways of eating. It's totally frustrating because for the average person out there just trying to look like what's for dinner, the messages are really confusing. You know, it's like the certain diet, the protein diets, the all meat, the no wheat diets, then local, organic, biodynamic. I mean, it's just it's a mishmash of different messages. So what I've tried to do in the third plate, in the book, The Third Plate, is add another label, but add another label that puts this together in a way that is a little bit easier to understand.
Well, Dan Barber, award-winning chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns Restaurants in New York, and co-owner and operator of a wonderful family farm in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, yes, as well, which I didn't get a chance to even ask you about. Come back next time and we will.
You.
The new book is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, listeners, stick with us because coming up, we'll talk about the Boston-based youth service organization City Year, which marks a quarter century this year. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.